When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Wednesday, the 18th of March, 2026, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, reviewing some of the top construction stories from the past couple of weeks. And a quick explainer, we are actually recording this podcast a few days ahead due to certain logistical complications. And so at least one of the topics we're likely to be discussing today could be overtaken by events, but I think things are moving very fast on a global scale, so hopefully we won't be too out of date.
Indeed. Morning, Dave. It's good to see that you got the dress code memo. We appear to be wearing exactly the same thing as I look at you in my computer screen.
This is my usual frock, actually. I always wear this when I'm podcasting.
Very nice it is.
I mean, the news, as anybody who's reads a newspaper, listens to a radio or uses a phone will know, has been a bit chaotic in the last couple of weeks. Things have kicked off in a big way in the Middle East, so a lot of the news is bad news. One story, though, from a bit of a domestic political story, actually, which broke a week or so ago, which I interpret as being bad news, which is news of a qualified plumber and recently qualified plasterer leaving the industry, like all the other rats leaving the sinking ship.
That's why you think it's bad news. It's the labour shortage is getting worse. I thought you'd say you don't want the Green Party to get MPs in the House of Commons.
No, I'm having checked out the new MP for Denton and Gorton up in Greater Manchester. I actually think that she's a highly qualified person, highly qualified for the trades. I don't know about her political capabilities, but she was a self-employed plumber, struggling self-employed plumber. Probably that explains why she went into politics. And I think only just qualified as a plasterer a couple of weeks ago.
It was during the election campaign. She was doing the course. I think she's probably on the course, and then the by-election was called, and she was selected as a candidate, I don't know the order of events, and carried on with her course to finish it off to get her plastering qualification.
Oh, she's called Hannah Spencer, by the way.
We should say that. Yes, Hannah Spencer, MP for...
New Green MP for Denton and Gorton.
Yes. Two things struck me. One, it is fabulous to have someone with a proper job, proper working experience getting to the House of Commons rather than someone from the, politico classes or another lawyer or whatever. So it's clearly an asset. Initially, I thought she was the first plumber ever to go into Parliament. But I quick bit of research, found that John Trickett, Labour MP he might still be there, I'm not sure. But if he's still in Parliament, it's been there a long time now. But he was the Leeds Council and is now became MP for Normanton and Hemsworth. But, I mean, there aren't that many women plumbers as it is. But for a woman plumber to become an MP is quite a story. What struck me more than anything was how hearing bits of her on the telly and her acceptance speech at the count, and then I watched on YouTube her maiden speech to Parliament. She doesn't sound like a Green MP. There's no mention of heat pumps in her in anything she's said.
She used to install them.
Or the environment or anything like that. Yes, I'll come back to that in a sec. The absolute absence of what used to be the Green Manifesto, and it's much more, I mean, she sounds very much like an old-fashioned labour class warrior, looking out for and promoting the interests of the poor, the needy, the minorities, and hard-working people. She made a point about hard-working people like her don't get the support from government they should and so on. So it's all very, conceivably even conservative, but certainly a Labour sounding, and not at all. You would not know she was a Green MP a Green Party member if you just heard what she had said. Now, I have no doubt that she, you know, does believe in ecological causes and so on, but it seems to be much more about Palestine. The environment in Palestine seems to be of a greater concern than the environment of the UK. So,
yeah.
But that's, I think that's the direction of, well, not direction of travel. That is the current location of the Green Party under its new leader, Zach Polanski. Zach Polanski himself has come lately to the Green cause. He was a Liberal Democrat member of the party before that. The whole, you know, what we're used to hearing from Caroline Lucas and people like that in the, you know, back in the day, where the Green Party was all about save the planet and the ozone layer, etc. It doesn't seem to be an issue now. It's save Palestine.
Well, I think everybody's on board with green issues. That's the thing. It's no longer the preserve of the Green Party.
I suppose so. Well, you say that. Nigel Farage isn't, of course.
No. All right, then. He's the exception that proves a rule. Yeah, but I think it is interesting, you know, the disappearance of Jeremy Corbyn, who tried to stage a comeback recently, but it failed spectacularly. I think that's left a vacuum for the left, and Zach Polanski and his party have jumped in to fill that gap.
They're very good at attracting attention.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think Hannah Spencer, I approve of her, partly because of her, you know, the fact that she's a qualified plumber and plasterer, which I heartily approve of. Zach Polanski, not so much. I feel that really his main issue is Zach Polanski rather than any political ideology. I don't find him an appealing character, unlike a lot of people, because he was elected leader of the Green Party on 85% of the votes, which I think itself is rather suspicious. That's the sort of thing you expect in the former Soviet Union, not in the Green Party.
Yes, well, there always seem to be a bit like the Scottish National Party, where it's got a nationalist party, where there's, it's sort of a single cause party, which is independence of Scotland, and the Green Party is sort of a single cause, the environmental issues used to be. And it always seemed to me there was if either of those two parties ever got into government, they would immediately have to break up, because it's, you can have a coalition of the left and a coalition of the right, as Conservative Party and, well, by the way, around the Labour Party and Conservative Party have demonstrated over the years. But there are two types of Green Party supporters, or have been. You've got your rural National Trust, bird-watching type of countryside-loving, small-c Conservative Green Party. And you've got your urban Greens, who are much more left wing, basically, more a socialist bent, and I think that the left wing, as opposed to the small c Conservative, the radical Greens, are absolutely, that's, you know, it's where the party is and where it wants to be.
Yes,
it's got no interest in, I don't think, in particular, or doesn't seem to demonstrate any interest in wooing members of CPRE or National Trust or you know, sort of the active countryside loving middle classes.
Yeah, I think you're right there. By the way, have you noticed if Hannah Spencer has actually been saying anything positive about the industry? She mentioned the construction industry and the trades and stuff like that. I mean, you mentioned she's championed, and I've noticed in what I've read about her that she's particularly angry about the growing rift between the super rich and the rest of us. But is she banging the drum for small tradespeople like her, you know?
Well, I haven't heard her say. I've only actually seen her acceptance speech and her maiden speech in Parliament.
Yeah,
it was more about she wants more people from her sort of background, you know, people who have got trades, people who work with the house, getting into Parliament, and she hopes she's, you know, blazing a trail is a bit putting a bit strong, but you know, shining a light on what, you know, what can be done and what people, you know. You don't assume that just because you're a plumber or a plasterer that going into politics is beyond you, out of your reach, not something for you.
No. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is also a good thing. I think, you know, the more people are get, not necessarily run for Parliament, but just join their local party of whatever colour, but just get active and, or even just vote.
Yes.
not enough voting going on.
Well, good luck to her anyway. I hope she does some good with her in her new position. And I hope that not too many plumbers and plasterers decide to follow her into Parliament, because we need more tradespeople and fewer politicians, if you ask me.
I did look her up on the... you mentioned that she's in the business of, or had been doing heat pump installations. I hadn't read that. But I looked her up on the Gas Safe Register just out of curiosity, and I couldn't find Hannah Spencer of her location on the Gas Safe. Now, maybe I was using it wrong. Maybe she is Gas Safe registered. But it seems to me, if you're a plumber, particularly installing heat pumps or doing anything to do with heating systems, might be handy. Yes. Might be handy to be Gas Safe registered.
Well, not that she needs it now, Wikipedia. No, of course not. Well, her Wikipedia page says that she took an apprenticeship to complete an MVQ as a gas engineer. Doesn't say that she completed it. Says she took the apprenticeship to complete it. That's a bit. I don't know.
I have no doubt. I have no doubt she completed it. But being a gas engineer,
did she qualify?
You still got to pay your money, and maybe that was an
yes.
And maybe that's something we should explore. I don't know. Maybe a lot of self-employed plumbers are perfectly. Have the skills and the experience to be Gas Safe registered, but simply balk at however much it costs to do it. And if they do that, then they can't fill up the car with petrol, or they can't, you know, put food on the table or whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a financial decision forced upon plumbers. I don't know.
I don't know how much it costs to register. Not, I wouldn't have thought it was an awful lot, but I think it, you know, because it's a prerequisite. You have to be gas safe registered in order to do any gas work. And we know from the regular bulletins we get from the Health and Safety Executive that if you do any gas work without being gas safe registered, they throw the book at you. They don't hold back. I've just had my own gas boiler serviced by a young lad who is gas safe registered. I couldn't find him on the register either, because he's only just qualified and it hasn't actually gone up on there. But I did phone up his employer and check with them. And when he came round, I asked him to bring his paperwork. And I felt a bit embarrassed, actually, because I thought he's going to think I'm just a nosy Parker or
Harry Enfield character.
Yeah, exactly, something like that. But actually, he was quite pleased that I had bothered to check. And I suppose... If somebody does actually check, you know, and then you realise that your qualifications and your registration as a qualified gas fitter carry some weight with the customer base, then that must make you feel that it's been worthwhile. Should we move on, Phil, to the dismal news that is enveloping us all?
The problems facing all MPs, but more particularly the government, which is... the state of the nation's economy, more broadly the global economy. There was a general feeling that things were finally starting to get better. Obviously, the Labour government says it's all the Tories' fault. I would put it down to, I'm not saying the Tories did everything right, but coming out of COVID and then Russia invading Ukraine and those knock-on effects of that... We have been in it's similar to what happened after the great crash of 2008, 2009. It takes several years to get on the right footing. And there was no way Labour could immediately turn things around. But there was a feeling that after, 18 months, this year, 2026, would be when we start seeing things getting better. In fact, construction, although the PMI, Purchasers Managers Index, which is a monthly survey of sentiment, reckons that construction activity has been in decline every month since January 2025, that we've had 13, 14, 15 months of decline. That is not true according to official statistics. Or the official estimates, I should say, construction output in the UK grew by 1.8% in 2025, or if you strip out inflation, 1.2%, I think it is a real growth in construction activity last year. So there was some growth, not great, but the perception was things would get better this year. But what happened, though, is at the back end of 2025, there was a delay, I'm not sure that's the right word, but the budget was held later than usual. And that sort of 3 weeks with the budget being pushed back just meant investors, clients sat on their hands just for a little bit longer to wait to see what, you know, yeah. So wait to see what happens in the budget, see which way to jump. And that had an impact on the last quarter figures for the economy and for construction particularly. And then as the new year comes along or after the budget and think, okay, that's out of the way, let's open the doors and start, you know, set the horses free. We've had terrible weather, wet weather. It hasn't been terrible, but there's been a lot of rain for the first 2 months, 2.5 months of in the new year, which is a downer on construction work, as we know, obviously. So that's had an impact. And then the bombs start falling. First of all, I mean, it's bad enough what was going on in you know, the guard situation was making everything all a bit fragile. But when America starts bombing Iran and then bombs Iranian drones start dropping things in, you know, Dubai and other places.
It's all
looking a little bit tinderboxy. Price of petrol has gone up to, or oil, I should say, has gone up to $100 a barrel. Petrol prices have gone up and energy prices are going to go up. And how long that goes on for, we don't know. The war secretary in America says, oh, you ain't seen nothing yet, we're just getting started. And Trump says, no, we've already won, we're just about to say we've won.
Yes.
So we don't quite know what's going on there. For damn sure is that we know Iran aren't just going to go, oh, hands up, we'll give in, you know, we'll do what you say. So it's all... And then there was a spring statement, and everyone's going to go, oh, the spring statement, that's going to be, you know, great. A couple of weeks, beginning of March, the spring statement. And everyone thought it was going to be like a budget thing. It was going to say, we're going to give more money to this, that, and the other. But that was never what it was about. Anyone who thought that was had not been reading the papers. It was only ever it wasn't really even a fiscal event. It was just saying, This is the latest from what the Office of Budget Responsibility is saying, and this is where we are. You know, this is a statement of, like, an audit. This is where we're at. Yeah. And, of course, well, we've got all these press releases we always do say, oh, this is a missed opportunity. She should have said this, she should have said that. Well, that's irrelevant, folks, sorry. And we've had the infrastructure pipeline. It's another big thing. The second edition of the first revision of the infrastructure pipeline, the document of all the work that's supposedly coming down the line in the future. I haven't even looked at it because if it says things like Heathrow Terminal 5, sorry, yeah. I don't mean Terminal 5.
Third runway,
I beg your pardon. If it says things like third runway, you kind of go, yeah, right, that's in the pipeline, is it?
That old chestnut. Exactly. So, it's a very long pipeline.
Yeah, so I don't know. I was... A lot of people regarded it important and interesting, but I can't get excited by it because there's so much uncertainty.
No. In fact, the spring statement completely passed me by. I was actually on holiday that week.
Best place to be.
I wasn't paying much attention to what was going on. The one thing I did notice was that Rachel Reeves repeated the government's commitment to its 1.5 million new homes target, which I thought was completely dead in the water. In fact, below the waves by now. I don't think anybody seriously believes that commitment is worth anything anymore because they're simply not going to achieve it.
Well, I said before, if they start counting in student rooms,
yes,
you know, purpose-built student accommodation. Oh, yeah.
So I suppose we should watch out for
rooms.
That.
Is that 200 homes? It sort of is.
Well, there are people living in them, I suppose. But no, I mean, it's clearly we're in for some interesting times. When oil prices go up, everything is affected. Nothing really stays the same. Building materials, obviously, the cost of building materials will increase because of the cost of energy in producing them will increase. And the cost of doing the work will increase as well. So, you know, it's clearly going to be a difficult Yeah, certainly not the positive uptick that we were being told to expect. And as you say, I think, you know, the fact, I'm not going to air my own personal opinion of Donald Trump and his government.
That you just did.
But I I think anybody who can sort of read between the lines. But the thing is that he clearly thought that he could go in there, go bish, bash, bosh, job done, and that will be nearly 50 years of angst with Iran, this thorn that's been in the side of the United States for almost 50 years, that he would put an end to it once and for all, and that would guarantee success in the midterms later this year and put him back on top.
It's going to count against him in the midterms.
Oh, yes, of course it is. Yes, of course.
Do you know what I think? Bored of peace. He is bored of peace.
Oh, I see. Well, he virtually said that, didn't he?
No, he set up a board of peace.
Yeah, I know, but he didn't. He say that when the Nobel Committee failed to give him the Peace Prize, which he clearly didn't. You know, he said he thought he deserved, and actually managed to obtain by snatching it from the Venezuelan premier, opposition leader. No, he did say that. Yeah, I've had enough of peace. You know, you can stuff peace. If you're not going to give me the prize, forget it. Words to that effect.
I don't know. He got the football peace prize though. Maybe he'll have to give that.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. Oh God. Yes. Yeah. When you look at the personalities involved in this war that's going on in the Middle East at the moment, it really does make your blood run cold because there seems to be no strategy, and the people conducting it seem to be living in some sort of fantasy world. Have you seen that video which they produced to basically publicise the war? Have you seen it?
I haven't.
I think it was Pete Hegseth, who calls himself the Secretary of War, unveiled this video, which was a mashup of clips from action movies and video games, with all the sort of the dramatic music and bombastic noise that you expect to hear from those sort of productions. Just basically saying we're going to go in and finish the job, and you know you won't. You won't know what's hit you and stuff like that. It does really feel as if they're not living in the real world. It's just some sort of computer game for them.
That's possibly what... I think it was Hugo Rifkin, Times columnist, certainly on the Times columnist, I think it was Hugo Rifkin, was a piece which I very much approved of, commenting on how in days of yore, even when we thought, you know, George W. Bush was a bit of a potato head, he would, you know... Every other political leader from the history of time would always recognise that people had died. That, you know, when you drop the bomb, you think, you know, it's sad people have died and whatever. And the American leadership appear to be revelling and glorifying in the deaths rather than, you know, seeing it as an unfortunate, inevitable byproduct of going to war.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. Normally people say, you know, this is a regrettable consequence of war. War is nasty, it's dirty, and we regret that these things happen. But there's none of that coming out of Washington. And in fact, I don't know whether when this podcast goes out, whether or not we've actually had any movement on the suspicion. I think it's more than a suspicion that it was an American Tomahawk missile that landed on that school in Iran and killed, I think, 160 or so people, including mostly kids, I think. But I did hear only this morning, actually, part of an interview with Donald Trump by a British journalist who was asking about this. And he said, well, you know, I don't know about that, which I think is an abdication of responsibility when the president of the United States says he doesn't know when he's asked about something as important as that. But then he went to say, he said, you know, other people have tomahawks. Iran has tomahawks. I wish they had more. I couldn't believe what I was hearing because, I mean, that's just a blatant lie. Everybody knows that the only people who have tomahawks are America, us, the Netherlands, and one other European country, I can't remember.
Not everyone knows that. I've got no idea who's got
tomahawks. But not Iran. They haven't got them. Yeah. And, Anyway, so it's all it's a real shit show out there, and we're going to catch some of the flack. It's quite inevitable, I think.
Well, one of the things going back to domestic construction, one of the things we suffered from the construction industry not very long ago. Do you remember when that big ship got stuck in the
In the Suez Canal.
Suez Canal. Yeah. And added to the supply chain disruptions.
Yeah.
Well, Iran are taking, is it the Straits of Hormuz? My geography is not very good.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Apparently, you know, if they block that, we're going to have supply chain problems again. So for the past year or so, maybe 2 years, there haven't really been any problems with getting materials from around the world into the country. Now, there might very likely to be holdups on that front, raising up again.
I think the Straits of Hormuz, which is between the Gulf states, Oman, Qatar, and you know the rest of them, and Iran, specifically, it's oil traveling through there. That's I don't think there's any other. It's not like the Red Sea, you know, the Suez Canal, where all sorts.
It's not like container ship from China.
No, I don't think so. I think it is. I might be wrong, but I suspect because it doesn't really go anywhere. Once you get up in there, it just goes to all those oil states up in the Gulf there, and so I think it's primarily oil. But the oil is the lifeblood, so it doesn't really matter if it doesn't stop fridges getting through or televisions or computer chips. It's oil, and all those other products need the oil for their production. And unless things do settle down very quickly, and there is talk about President Trump being able to actually define what he means by victory and declaring it when it suits him, which would give him an excuse to get out, basically, and leave things as they are. If he thought this isn't going very well, I need to pull out as soon as possible, then we might be okay, you know. But I think that the fact that the Iranian government, in the face of all that, all those munitions and the rest of it, aren't showing any signs of backing down, I suspect that it will go on much, much longer than anybody in Washington was expecting. And as I say, I think that we'll feel the effects of that.
Sometimes when these things happen, there's a peace dividend of lots of big reconstruction contracts, mainly for American companies, your Bechtels and whoever, can go in and say, oh, we'll rebuild the country. That ain't going to happen in Iran, I don't think.
No, I don't think so. Oh, dear. So, well, it's tricky times, basically.
Right. Well, as you said at the top, we are speaking some days before our listener is hearing this, so things may have moved on. So, fingers crossed, they move on the right direction. Right, change the subject, yeah?
Yeah, why not? Well, we're talking, as I was saying, you know, Trump might want to get out before things get nasty. But I think our last topic is about people getting out, not necessarily before things turn nasty, but senior figures in the construction industry have been retiring recently. And the most recent one is the boss of Vistry, which, according to the Times, you sent me a couple of clips from the Times, Vistry is the second largest house builder in the UK. According to my calculations, they're the third largest after Taylor Wimpey. But I think...
Have you included is that post-Countryside merger acquisition?
Yes. Right. Yeah. Well, hang on. Vistry's latest results that I've quoted here are from June 2025. So,
Be talking money or units?
No, this is it. I was going to say, I'm talking money. I think the Times talking units.
Right.
Because Vistry, of course, is unlike the top player in the market, Barratt Redrow, which is, you know, very much in the speculative market. Vistry, of course, has been turning its focus far more on affordable homes. And I think what they call partnerships, working in partnership with social housing landlords, housing associations,
But this whole partnership, it's kind of a misnomer. It is what it's called. But what they're essentially, Vistry is now doing, and we should say, rewind, Greg Fitzgerald, the chief executive and chair of this company, he hasn't actually, but he's done, he's announced that he will quit as chief executive as soon as they can find a successor. He'll continue for up to 12 months or until a successor is appointed as chief executive. And he will quit as chair on the 13th of May at the AGM. Mm-hmm. So he's not going immediately, but he's saying, I want to go. He's announced his he says retirement. He's not retiring. He's younger than I am. He's he'll do something else.
But of course.
He's moving on. Vista, one of his big things, Vista, he acquired Linden Homes from his old company, Galliford Try, where he was chief exec for 10 years. And then he acquired Countryside Properties. And both of those are sort of social housing, whereas Vistry, Bovis Homes, as it was before all this started happening, was much more of a traditional speculator. We'll buy some land, we'll put up some houses, and we'll sell them to whoever wants to buy them. And the problem with the traditional method is that you don't get the money in for what you're doing until you've sold the house at the end of the process.
Yeah.
So you're always kind of relying on money coming in from old built developments being sold to pay for new developments. And so you've got this sort of circle going and you're having to juggle. He decided, or persuaded his board to decide, that Vista's new thing is we're not going to do that. They're still doing it a bit because they've got a land bank which they need to build out. But instead of doing that, they're effectively a contractor. They go to a housing association or a housing association comes to them who wants a block of flats built or a row of terraces built or whatever and says, you want this? Give us the money, we'll build it. So you get the money up front. And so it's a much less cash-thirsty model.
And you're not really at the vagaries of the property market, are you?
No.
I mean, house prices can go up and down when the wind changes. But, it's more reliable, I suppose.
But where they came a cropper, where you can come a cropper with that sort of thing, is you say, we'll build that for whatever. Give us 100 million and we'll build that for you. And you go, okay, we'll do that. Deal signed. 2 years later, when you finally get on site, or a year later when you finally get on site, all the costs have gone up and there's been a period of inflation. Yeah. And I think this street, it has been reported that they've become slightly a cropper over that. And we, everyone reported 18 months ago, autumn 2024.
The end of 2024, wasn't it?
That their southern division, they'd uncovered miscalculations in the costs by quite a huge factor. 165 million is the figure. 165 million pounds are out. The costs of these jobs that they were doing as a contractor, effectively, and they had to swallow that, or rather, their shareholders had to swallow that. And if you look at a graph of Vista's share price over the past couple of years, it's been very volatile, up and down, all over the place. And I mean, to some, Greg Fitzgerald is, a visionary, a hero, a great guy. And to others, it's you might have got this one wrong. And I've never spoken to him or met the man, but certainly his story is straight out of the I was going to say rule book. I don't mean that, but the storybook of construction tycoons. He had his little house building business. He sold it, set up another one, sold that. Then the person he sold it to said, "Come and run our house building business." And then he becomes chief executive, and it's Galliford Try, and it becomes the top of the company. And then he goes to be chief executive of Bovis Homes.
Yeah.
Buys half of Galliford Try that he left behind, buys another big company, builds up this huge company.
Yeah.
He's got an awful lot of stock. He owns something like 0.5% of Vistry, which I know doesn't sound a lot, but it's a lot of stock. He's also chairman and quite a big shareholder in Ardent. I think he's still chair.
Really? I didn't know that.
The telehandler hire people, which is quite a cunning number, because, of course, Vistry use a lot of telehandlers on their site.
Not half.
So, they're going to use Ardent telehandlers. So that's a nice bit of synergy. There have been certain mutterings about, if it was public sector, you'd talk about conflicts of interest, but it's not. This is just good business. Private sector, you can do it. The Times journalist obviously knows him, better than I do, did a piece on it saying, he said, at the age of 61, there comes a time, Fitzgerald apparently said, there comes a time when you just think life's for living and he wants to spend more time, doing other things.
Yeah.
Quote, he's not short of a few bob either. That'd be absolutely minted.
he certainly isn't. No.
Well, although he's not as minted as he has been because the share price has gone down. Yeah. He's got, he just bought a whole bunch more last week of shares, several hundred thousand pounds, but a huge, more than you and I would ever speculate on any company when it was at its, a low ebb, take advantage of that. So when the share price does go up, he'll be minted again. But there's some questions about why now as to why he's going. And I've got no answer to that, but, there'll be plenty of speculation. Is it because the Financial Reporting Council is sniffing around? They're not sniffing around the company or him. There's no certain they've done any wrong. They're sniffing around the two accountants who used to work for the company at the time when those miscalculations were unearthed 18 months ago, 17 months ago, whatever it was. But it's just a bit of heat. But he doesn't seem like the kind of person, from everything I read about him, to run away from heat. But I suspect he rather loves it.
Yeah.
One of those.
Yeah, he gives that impression. I mean, I'm sure he'll be fine, whatever happens. And Vistry will probably be fine, once they've sort of, it's just a sort of a block in the road, really, isn't it? They'll get that sorted out. Who knows what happened 18 months ago when the miscalculation was actually being miscalculated. It might have just, I think we said at the time, because we did discuss it, that it smelled more like incompetence than corruption. And I think it's probably, the fact they're investigating two accountants now suggests that maybe it wasn't just incompetence. There might have been something else involved. But
I don't think there's been a whiff of malfeasance. I think it is human error. But the question is whether, people with accountancy qualifications after their name should be allowed to have accountancy qualifications after their name if they make errors of the thought that they may have done. And I think that's what's being investigated.
It was the plummeting share price. That was in response to Fitzgerald's announcement, wasn't it? That he said, I'm going to be leaving. And the share price promptly plummeted. Was it that, or was it something else that caused the price to slide?
Well, February the 26th, it started to dive. So that was that the date of his?
I think that might have been.
No, that was later. 4th of March, he announced he was going.
Oh, right, okay, right.
So it already started sliding then. And the Financial Reporting Council release was later than that as well. So it could just have been the, what we were talking about before, the whole construction market being a bit rubbish.
Yeah, quite probably. Who else has decided they're going to
throw
in the towel, isn't it?
Well, the people who've recently gone at the top of the industry, and it's just not news, but it's not that long ago, Andrew Davies of Kia, who did a pretty good job turning around, and there you could say, job done, I'm off. And Leo Quinn at Balfour Beatty, much the same story. I think he was at Balfour Beatty rather longer than Andrew Davies at Kia. But both of those men came into these companies at a time when they were looking rather fragile financially.
Yes.
And put them onto a pretty sure footing. And it was just simply, you've earned your money, go get yourself a speedboat. there probably are others going, actually. Yeah. I can't think who they are. I think, Berkeley. Do you call it Berkeley or Barclay? I always call it Barclay.
I call it Barclay.
It's Barclay, isn't it? It's Americans who call it Berkeley.
Yeah.
Rob Perrins has moved upstairs.
Okay.
There. So anyway, it happens. It comes in these waves of change. And to be honest, if, now for many people might think, it's quite a good time to move on and hand over. But we'll revisit this story in due course, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think so. But the way things are going at the moment, it makes sense to say, right, I think I'm off. I don't want to be involved. Because, there'll be a lot of work to do and a lot of sleepless nights, I should think, for a lot of CEOs.
On the other hand, if the sunny uplands are just around the corner, wouldn't you want to be
yes, because then you claim credit. Happens.
Yeah. When the share prices go up, you can cash in all your options and then go.
Yeah, that's true. So is that it?
I think that concludes our business. But any other?
I think it does.
Any other business? I just wanted to mention an interesting email I received. I don't know if you received it as well, from the head of communications and marketing at Farrans, the Northern Ireland construction company.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm speaking out of turn, but I'm going to say it anyway. They're doing a survey of trade journalists, and I'm sure lots of other people, probably clients, subcontractors, suppliers as well, I'm sure. But they're doing a brand perception audit Farrans is conducting. And they commissioned the consultancy to do some research to find out what do people really think of the Farrans brand. And you immediately go, this is interesting. Why are they doing that? Farrans was acquired not very long ago at all by John Sisk. In fact, the deal was completed at the beginning of November last year. And John Sisk said at the time of acquiring Farrans, they bought it from CRH, the building materials company, Farrans was very much a... I mean, Farrans is a good-sized company, but it was very much a non-core for CRH.
Yeah, yeah.
Sisk said, we're going to keep it as Farrans. We're not going to change the brand. We're not going to merge it with us. We're going to leave it alone, let them get on with things, do their own thing. So they're a good company who are doing things. Well, you know, it ain't broke. We're just going to perhaps have some, I'm sure there'll be back office savings, etc. But essentially, the story of the November was they're keeping the Farrans name. And now Farrans are doing a brand perception audit. That suggests to me, well, one of two things. Either Sisk is thinking of dropping the Farrans brand.
Farrans brand, even though
it said it wasn't. And people at Farrans are kind of going, ooh, that'd be a really bad thing to do because, you know, we've got a really valuable brand. Do we want to, you know, provide evidence? You can't prove it, but you can provide evidence of the value of the brand. Or Sisk aren't thinking that, but Farrans are worried that their new owners are going to do that. And that's a sort of a rearguard action just in case to make sure that no one comes up with the loopy idea of dropping the Farrans brand. Because I personally think the Farrans is a good brand. It's a company I have high regard for. Married to a Belfast woman for the past 30 plus years. I have a certain bias and affinity towards anything Northern Irish anyway.
Yeah.
In fact, even before I met my wife, my first trip to Northern Ireland was to visit Farrans and John Graham joint venture in the construction of one of the bridges across the Lagan over there.
Well, there's one strong endorsement for the Farrans
If no one else, I'll vote Farrans.
Yeah, exactly.
But
I think it's off.
Final point. The other thing that struck me is that we don't know what Sisk paid for Farrans. They've said we're not telling you, and why should they? It's a private company. Sisk is a private company. You probably can find it somewhere in CRH's accounts, actually, if you trawl through there. But Sisk don't want to tell us how much they paid for Farrans. But presumably, whatever they paid, an element of that would be for the brand. Sometimes a lot of corporate acquisitions, you're only paying for the brand, really, because you're taking on debt and liabilities and all sorts of bad stuff. But what you're buying, what you're getting, what the good thing is the brand and, you know, some good people as well. Although you can always hire good people, just poach them rather than, you know, pay for them. So presumably Sisk had its own calculation of what the Farrans brand was worth. So Sisk shouldn't need to do a brand perception audit of Farrans. It should already have done that. It should already know. Yes. So
yeah, you can put a figure on it.
Anyway,
yeah.
Quite why they're doing it, we don't know, but I'm sure it'll all come out eventually.
I think there's a tendency when you get a takeover like this of one brand taking over another brand, both of which have a high degree of presence in the market. You know, there's clearly a value attached to them. But they say, well, no, we're going to keep the brand of the acquired firm because, you know, people recognise it and it's very... And of course, it does make sense. Of course, all the customers will have a relationship with this firm and you change its name and they'll feel perhaps a little bit disorientated by that. So it makes sense, initially at least, to keep that brand name intact so that you get continuity. But it's later on, I think, when things change and you've got the people saying, oh, no, you've got, I mean, I'm thinking about companies like Terex. That's a different story, where you've got a company which owns lots of brands and those brands remain separate. You know, they trade separately as different brands.
RSK.
But eventually, RSK, yes, that's a good one. That's a good example. Another one, well, I mean, the one I was thinking about was SGB, the scaffolding giant, biggest scaffolding company in the world. I don't even know what they're called these days. I can't remember. But, you know, you take over a brand like that and clearly it has a lot of cachet and it has value. And perhaps it's just then a gradual process of absorption. And that, you know, once you want, as the parent company, your brand awareness to be
enhanced,
preeminent.
Like being
yeah, exactly.
But what you're talking about, typically, what often happens, more often than not, I would say, is that in the case of Cisk and Farrens, it'll be Farrens for a while, then it'll become Cisk Farrens for you know, 5 years or something, and then the Farrens name will drop off, probably.
Yeah.
Especially if you've got a bloke called Cisk at the top of the Cisk company. I don't know if you have, actually. But and the other one that's interesting, where you've got lots of brands, is Renew, where actually I would say Renew is a rubbish brand. I don't think anyone really knows who Renew is, but they know their subsidiary companies. And the other one is VP, Vibroplant, people might know the name of, but VP, you don't know that name, but you know their subsidiary companies and they deliver and maintain.
Yeah.
The value of that is when you're sort of a mini conglomerate, is that you can sell bits whenever you want to and it has a brand and you can stand alone. But it's much harder for, you know, if Renew had, I don't know, Renew Railways or something, it'd be much harder to sell Renew Railway as opposed to your railway business, which has its own name.
Yes.
So it actually maintains, I think, more value in the business if you have all these discrete brands operating, collaborating, cooperating, sharing costs, but operating in the marketplace as independent, that you can sell it at any time you want if you want to go buy something else instead.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't affect sister companies within the group. They can, you know, they just steer a steady course. And, you know, you can sell off one of their sister companies. It won't make any difference to them. It's not like you're lopping off part of their portfolio.
What is interesting about Cisk and Farrens is there is quite a lot of overlap. It's not like one is pure building and one is pure civil engineering.
Hmm.
But they could move in that direction. And I think that's what I'd be, you know, inclined. If I was the owner of Cisk, I would be inclined to say Farrens is a civil engineering business. You know, like Edmund Nuttall, or became BAM Nuttall, and now they've kind of got the Nuttall bit now, and it's BAM. But, you know, you had Edmund Nuttall and you had the BAM Construction.
Yeah.
And it's quite clear that there are two different bits of the same company. Maybe they'll go down that route.
Meanwhile, they're just trying to decide whether or not to order that new letterhead and business card. Maybe that's why they're doing it. God, we just put in a big order for business cards.
Does anyone use business cards anymore?
I don't think so. I've got a box of them on my desk, actually. I never, ever look at them. And in fact, probably most of the people whose cards I've got in my box have retired long ago.
It might have still got a fax number on it.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Right, okay. Are we done? Are we done?
I think we're done. As you said, we ought to hope that not too much happens between now and when the podcast goes out. But things might have moved on in the meantime. And we'll make amends for that next time we meet.
And we'll be back just before Easter the next time we meet, David.
I know. I can't believe it. It feels like Christmas was only a couple of weeks ago.
It was. Right. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. As always, it's been great being with you. If you want to tell us anything, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk is a great way to get hold of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we look forward to hearing from you. But from David and I for another episode of Reconstruction, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from The Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.